We are broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Musqueam people. On today's episode, we are going to be talking about language in regards to neurodivergence. For anyone unfamiliar with the term neurodivergence, it pertains to divergence in the human brain and cognition. These divergences can pertain to mood, sociability, attention, and other things. And on today's episode, we have Jack. Jack is a volunteer in the Accessibility Collective, and this is his first episode.
Hi there.
Hi, Jack. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Just like an hour ago, I came back from stats course in psychology. Ooh. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
218.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty brutal.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, yeah, it is. And but honestly, it beats like biochem. Like every biology student I've ever talked to hates biochem because it has way too much chemistry in it. Mm-hmm. And every chemistry student hates biochem because there's too many.
Bio.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So it's like the crap. How's language here on the show?
Let's refrain from swearing.
Okay, it's the worst of both worlds.
Yeah, no, for sure. Strangely enough, my dad loved it. He did biochem.
Well, we were just talking about this literally a second ago.
Yeah,
like he works in biochem, so
I think he just works in general research now, and I don't know what that entails. I know he used to do cancer research.
Okay.
But he did his undergraduate degree and his PhD in biochemistry.
Cancer research is a pretty cancer research is one of those fields that is it's pretty virtuous when you say hey, I work in cancer and all that type of stuff, but then you get into the nitty gritty and there's a lot of fraud in cancer research.
Yeah, there's a lot of fraud in a lot of research.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are we just gonna start with the questions?
Sure. So Jack, what are you studying?
I'm studying psychology at the moment.
And Jack is hopefully going to graduate soon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Everything kind of went on pause when it came to my graduation because of COVID. Mm-hmm. And that's not really – I'm not the only one. So, yeah. But, I'll be hoping to get my degree in November. Mm-hmm. I already have, a minor in – funny enough, I have a minor in philosophy.
Oh.
And that was because I was in a – program beforehand where I had to take a lot of philosophy, and when I switched over the philosophy credits were still there.
Philosophy minor.
Yeah, yeah. I just sort of walked back. I just sort of walked blindly into it by chance. So
yeah, there you go.
Again, it still looks good. It still looks good on a diploma. It looks good on a resume. To have both a minor and a major, and it's also I like to think it's good for grad school. But again, I gotta talk to advisors about that. But mm-hmm. That's a lot of people's experience.
What do you particularly focus on in psychology?
Some of the topics I like.
Yeah.
Well, I like neurodiversity. Mm-hmm. I like the dynamics between psychology and society.
Okay.
This was way before I came to UBC. When I was in Langara, I thought about being a sociologist.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that one of the things that we're going to talk about today, the social model of describing disability, actually came from sociologists.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there was I like to analyze those two aspects. And
So you're kind of interested in how psychology operates within society.
Yeah,
and also neurodivergence.
Yeah, and also understanding people understanding people and how they work and how they function, and also to get my level to their level and to have them come to my level.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you understand how people think, you can get into a different perspective and you can have a more cooperative dialogue with one another.
Yeah. So in the previous episodes, we have talked about these two different models of language, the medical model and the social model.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other models, but I feel like it's easiest to understand those two.
Yeah.
So the medical model kind of takes any form of quote-unquote disability, neurodivergence, mental illness, and says there is something wrong with you.
Yeah.
That we need to fix.
Yeah.
Yeah. For example, someone who has a broken leg. The society is going to be there's something wrong with you, we need to fix it.
Yeah.
And there are some instances where I feel I personally feel that's appropriate. Your quality of life is going to be better if your leg is not broken.
Of course.
But then there are also some instances where a lot of conditions are chronic or lifelong and there's not a whole lot you can do with it. And treating it like a constant burden is not great.
Yeah.
So things like using a wheelchair, things like neurodivergence, things like bipolar disorder, when they're kind of alienated from society and the medical system tells you, hey, there's something wrong with you. That's not super conducive with, like, a healthy relationship with society, in my opinion.
Well, a lot of it is about diminishing or reducing the effects of the quote-unquote disability has. Mm-hmm. So, like, again, under the medical model, and this is to its extreme, and you were talking about, you know, being handicapped, wheelchair, being someone in a wheelchair. So, a medical model will basically say, like, you know, this is the circumstance that you're in. It can be long-term or short-term, but here's what you got to do. You got to work on your arm strength so you can, like, push yourself around and all that type of stuff. And in the most radical sense, there might not even be ramps. So you would have, if you would be in a wheelchair, you'd have to literally, like, go up on the stairs. And that just requires more difficulty. But moving on to more about what the medical model is and how it developed. It basically developed in the 19th century, mainly from psychologists, therapists. A lot of, like, there was an explosion of wanting to understand the human body at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, physiology, psychology, just, like, the whole makeup of the human organism. And at least in the history of autism, it was originally once connected to schizophrenia. And it took a long time. It wasn't until the 1950s when there was a separation. And that's when autism was diagnosed, you know, as itself, particularly when it came to, you know, children. Because, like, autism beforehand was basically seen as, like, an early onset form of schizophrenia. And then as time and research went on, it was like, no, they're very two different mm-hmm. diagnoses.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was not until the 1950s in America when some of the first diagnoses of autistic people with autism came about. And a lot of it is about normalization. So normalizing their behavior to the general population.
That's funny that you actually caught yourself right there and you went autistic, people with autism, because that relates to one of our points, identity first language.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing I think is pretty common in the medical field, is they tend to say autistic person, depressed person, mm-hmm. schizophrenic person,
yeah.
disabled person.
Yeah.
They tend to use identity first language,
yeah.
which for some people, some folks with disabilities, they find that empowering. They're like, it's very much so a part of me. I wouldn't have it any other way. But for some others, it's rather offensive.
Yeah, it could also deny someone's personality. Like,
oh, for sure.
Sometimes, like, a lot, like, not, like, you don't even actually have to say person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that, like, you don't even have to use the word person in describing someone in identity first language. You can just say, oh, he's a schizophrenic. Oh, he's autistic. Or he's autistic. Oh, she is, you know, with she's just someone with Asperger's or something like that. Mm-hmm. But again, like, you can actually even just eliminate the person, which is a very scary thought, and it can also lead to a lot of huge radical problems. And that's one of the problems with identity first language, is, like, you can almost use it to erase someone's personality and their humanity. And when you do that, you dehumanize. It's a dehumanizing process. Like, it's a way of just treating them as a symptom rather than as someone with autonomy, with agency, with someone with personhood. And, you know, again, a lot of problems can come to that, because there's huge issues with abuse. There's huge issues with violence against people who are disabled. Like, coming from, like, you know, me being someone with autism, I look up these stats in general, and people with autism are more likely to be incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
They're more likely to be physically assaulted, sexually assaulted. Mm-hmm. They're more likely to experience violence in their lifetime done onto them. And identity first language can help facilitate that type of harm. I hope I'm not going on a bit of a diatribe here and getting a little bit too dark. But
I think that it's interesting. People usually tend to attack what they don't know or don't understand, which is why normalization is so important.
Yeah.
For example, I mean, I am not neurodivergent, nor do I think. Actually, Sam recently has made me been rethinking that, whether or not I want to identify with a disability. That's a whole other topic for another day.
Yeah.
But that is, like, another interesting thing is I have had some pretty severe mental health issues for most of my life. And I have a lot of friends, and they love me dearly, but they don't understand it, and they tend to poke a lot of fun at me. They make a lot of jokes about my state, and, like, sometimes it's the right time, and it's appropriate to be self-deprecating and poke a little humor down at the mental illness, but sometimes it transcends into poking fun at me.
Yeah.
And that's, like, it's not nearly as extreme as, like, violent battery against someone.
But oh, God,
it's,
no.
Like, a similar concept in the sense that people tend to put down what they don't understand.
Yeah. It's also a way of them releasing nerves as well, because, like, when you don't understand something, you're trying to make sense of it. And how can you make sense of it? Well, you can, you know, use it in a humorous context. Kind of humor is subjective, but everybody laughs. That's sort of a thing I've noticed.
Mm-hmm.
What makes them laugh is very different. So when they don't know something, they kind of just sort of try to accommodate it the best they can. And humor can be a very relaxing, nerve-releasing function. Mm-hmm. So they might be going to that. But again, it comes back, like, it can be very microaggressive after a while. Like, it just builds up and then it just collapses on, and then it just sort of collapses on you from time to time. Like, I've had to, like, as I've grown older, I've used self-deprecation as a means to sort of help myself through the pain as well. But then I realized it's like, oh, when I do this type of humor, are they laughing with me or, like, at me?
Yeah, and it's also just sometimes it's not giving yourself the space to feel pain, which is very necessary for healing. Healing requires some level of taking yourself seriously. And sometimes joking about it is, like, not the way to do it. There's a time and a place is what we're saying.
Oh, yeah. Like, if I was to get, like, a bad mark on a grade or something like that, and again, this is a university campus, so I hope listeners can feel this, but I think you should be able to sort of joke and laugh at yourself rather than view it as the end of the world. It's like, eh, God dang it, I done goofed on this exam. But there's always the next one.
Yeah.
And it just tells you to, like, well, maybe I just got to slap some sense into me and study harder and all that, and, you know, that type of stuff. Like, I've had those experiences. But, again, humor is kind of a neutral thing. Humor is a neutral function. It can be used for being ill or for being bad. Like,
it's a tool that needs to be used wisely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but it can also be used to deflect and also to just, to cover up really nasty views and concepts and ideas.
Yeah, that's why I have a lot of, like, people are always like, oh, you're reading too much into it, but I have a lot of thoughts on stand-up comedy. But anyways, we're going to go to ad break right now, but once we return, we will be discussing the social model.
Yeah.
About 40% of UBC students experience food insecurity. Sprouts is hosting a weekly produce market from 10:30 to 1:30 every Monday in the Life Building. With produce from local farms, students are free to take whatever they want. Sprouts Cafe is open from Monday to Thursday and is offering 30 free meals a day, completely free and no questions asked. They also host Community Eats, a completely free hot lunch that is open for all. Stop by and support the Sprouts cause for sustainable, accessible food at UBC.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
Are you a current current student or a past student of UBC's GRSJ program who's looking for a chance to showcase their work?
Join GRSJ Undergraduate Association for their annual F-Word event on March 8th and 9th. GRSJ students, faculty, and alumni are invited to talk and share their artwork, written pieces, crafts, and more with regard to this year's theme, youth activism. It's an opportunity for GRSJ students to share their work and view their peers' work. The deadline to submit your work is March 3rd. You can visit their link in their Instagram bio at GRSJUA_UBC to find the link to submit your work. For more information, you can also reach out to GRSJ Undergraduate Association by email at grsjundergraduates@gmail.com.
Make sure to check out the F Word event on March 8th and 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. on the second floor of the Arts Student Center.
Hi, welcome back. This is Nicole, and you're listening to All Access Pass, a show brought to you by the Accessibility Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. Welcome back, and I'm back here with Jack. Hello.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking about the social model, because we just finished talking about the medical model a little bit. So the social model, what is it?
It's a sociological way of framing disability. So it developed mainly in like the 80s and 90s. I believe in like the first few countries were in Australia and the UK that kind of looked at this approach. Or starting to develop this approach to talking about disability. And it looks at how society affects people with disabilities. So it looks at systematic barriers, derogatory attitudes like ableism, and also look at features of society that limit a person's, a person with disabilities' ability to live in that society. If you have a society that doesn't have, like, any ramps or doesn't consider putting a ramp, or anything like that, then, like, that's going to affect people who are either in wheelchairs, who even walk on crutches, or, you know, who might just be randomly born with a leg condition. Like, it's a sociological way of looking, like, the social model allows for a sociological way of looking at disability, and that also gets away from pathologizing individual people with a disability.
Yeah, so something that came about the social model is something called person-first language. So that's something we touched on earlier. Mm-hmm. So, for example, instead of saying an autistic person, you would say a person with autism.
Yeah.
And by saying that, you kind of remind the world that this person isn't just autism. They like have a personality and a life and like, you know, and kids and whatever. Why do you think that's important?
Because one, some disabilities are just not really seen very quickly. Like if you were to know, like, someone who's, again, going back, like if someone is in physical disability, it's way more direct.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can kind of know when someone has leg issues or is impaired in eyesight and all that type, in that kind of stuff. But like some people, when I talk to them, I tell them that I'm autistic and they go, wow, you're so normal.
Like, what does that mean?
That's like, you know, it's like someone from a different, like, and I think as some, maybe someone who comes from a non-white background, yeah, when you say that you're Canadian, it's like, no, where are you from? Oh, well, I'm from Vancouver. No, where are you from?
Yeah.
That type of question. Which is like it's almost a questioning of who you are.
Yeah.
Moving it back a little bit, person first language kind of developed with the social model, but also developed with the emerging neurodivergence movement. And again, it was basically to avoid the pitfalls that we kind of talked about earlier with identity first language, which is the potential annihilation of personhood. So you can easily in identity first language, it doesn't really matter if you call someone schizophrenic or a schizophrenic person. You can easily just take the person out and just leave the symptom there.
Yeah,
that's the problem with identity first language. But with the person first language, that's an impossibility. Personhood is built into the way you're describing, into your description. Mm-hmm. So there's less chance of dehumanization. And when you don't dehumanize something, you have to treat it with some sort of
respect,
ethical value, and someone with autonomy. Like, you know, like very common conceptions of what we think of when we think of a person. Yeah, like when we think of a human or a person.
I've never really thought about the potential consequences of... I've always just been like, yeah, it's kind of like disrespectful. But I've never thought about like the whole dehumanization aspect of it. Because absolutely, you would see a bunch of people be like, oh, that like schizophrenic, which is like, whoa, that person has so many other things other than just having schizophrenia.
Yeah.
And it gets dangerous. It's like segregation.
Yeah.
So I've never thought about why the language we use would be so important.
Well, yeah, because it builds patterns. Sense. It builds patterns and all that type of stuff. And like, there's some overlap between, you know, disability research and, you know, there's a lot of similarities between that and racial studies in psychology. If you were to only think in stereotypes and all that type of stuff, it's going to affect how you view other people. It's going to affect how you view people outside of your group, of your designated group and all that type of stuff. And again, there's a lot of differences, but there's a similarity of language has an impact on the way you categorize the world.
Yeah, that actually makes me think of this recent like personal anecdote. So I pretty recently, a doctor was like, you definitely have borderline personality disorder. And I was like, this is not the same doctor we were talking about recently.
This
is a different doctor.
Well, how long have you, is this like the first session or an only session?
I don't know. He was a psychiatrist. We talked for like 2 hours. We did like a pretty intense evaluation.
Okay.
I think we can do another episode another day about the whole like what it means to diagnose someone. But we won't get into that today.
Yeah.
Anyways, but the point isn't my like personal diagnoses with borderline personality disorder. It's the fact that I proceeded to go on an internet deep dive. Not smart. Don't do it. Don't be like me. But it's like watching a car crash. You know, you just can't take your eyes away. but I was reading about borderline personality disorder, and now that I think about it, all the language that was used, and it didn't help that I was on forums like Quora and Reddit. I'm just like revealing that I'm like so irresponsible on the internet, like trusting sources about mental health from Quora and Reddit.
Yeah, yeah.
But basically, people would just be like, yeah, like BPD, borderlines, whatever. They wouldn't say people with borderline disorder, they just say borderlines.
Yeah.
And that was like a really gross, nasty feeling in my chest that I couldn't like quite put my finger on until like literally right now. I was like, this is why I feel so uncomfortable and awful reading these articles. It's because I feel like I am being segregated from the rest of the world by being called like a borderline. And that didn't help that the like questions would be like, do borderlines deserve love? And I'm like, oh my God. Yeah, it was absurd. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
It was pretty bad. Anyways, don't be like me. Don't internet deep dive. Maybe read a happy book.
Do borderlines deserve love? Jesus.
Yeah, and it's everyone, like, there were some, like, professional psychologists in the comments that were like, they're people. they do deserve love. I don't know what you're talking about.
The hell are you talking, like,
it was pretty rough. Anyways, but I never thought about that whole, like, dehumanization aspect. Or, like, and connected that to my own experience of people talking about borderline personality disorder. Borderlines. And I was like, wow, this is, like, really discouraging, but I can't quite figure out why. So, that is also why person first language is really, really freaking important.
Yeah. Well, like, yeah, because, again, like, the way you describe people and describe certain situations and... it can really have an impact. Like you were talking about crash. There's been experiments where you use the word like watching a train crash. If you were to show two groups, two sets of people, cars colliding together,
mm-hmm.
and you're described one as crashing into one another, And then you to one group, and you would show to another group. They bumped into each other rather than crashed into each other. There's a distinction made, because in one group, the word crash is such, it has more intensity to it. Mm-hmm. There's a more intense connotation to the word crash than bump. I actually bumped into a chair or something like yeah. that. Like, it could be, like, it seemed like
crash into the chair paints a very different image.
Yeah. It's about painting an image in your head. And again, the difference with language, going back to identity first language and person first language, when, again, like, I want to keep reiterating this point because I think it's very important, is that identity first can have a tendency. It's not inherently bad. Like, none of these concepts are inherently bad or good or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But identity first language has the ability and has the tendency to collapse all distinctions and reduce someone to their disability.
Yeah.
And in person first language, they treat the disability as part of the person, not the whole. Maybe there's, you know, maybe that's the big distinction. Medical or identity first language, which comes from the medical view of disabilities, treats the disability as the whole, because they're trying to fundamentally, they view it as a disease, so they're trying to cure it. And it comes from, and that mindset comes from medical professionals. Mm-hmm. The people who've started
Any sign of deviance from what the quote-unquote average normal person is? Which is is there an average? Is there a normal?
I think it's constructed. Yeah, I think exactly. Normality is kind of a constructed thing. Like, the word normal comes from the word norm, which was it's a math term. It means it originally meant a 90 degree angle, and most things are not 90 degree angles.
Yeah.
So
a lot of people these days, I feel like, are like, oh, everyone these days is mentally ill or neurodivergent or something or other. And I'm like, I think we're all kind of just realizing that no one is truly quote unquote normal.
Yeah.
There is no standard.
Well, wasn't there there was a professor, he wrote this huge book and got a lot of attention for a while. I don't know if he works at UBC, but there's this book called The Myth of Normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it sort of talks about that.
I believe it's on sale at Chapters right now.
Are you plugging for Chapters?
No, I just was looking at Chapters the other day. And I was like, oh, this book's on sale.
Yeah.
Anyways, continue.
I don't know. I work at a bookstore.
Which bookstore do you work at?
Well, it's not working. I volunteer. I'm on pause at the moment to basically focus on school. But we have this one poster that says, don't steal from us. Go to Chapters.
Oh, my God. What bookstore is it?
Spartacus Books.
Okay.
Yeah, but in all seriousness, normalcy it doesn't really exist, but it's you ever seen SpongeBob memes?
Yes, I have.
There's one SpongeBob meme where he's not square anymore, he's circular.
Yeah.
And he has no holes in it, and he just a dead sort of face, smiles and all that type of stuff. If there's a platonic form of normalcy, that picture is kind of it. Again, normalcy should not be considered as something that exists in an individual, but it should be seen as a standard.
Mm-hmm.
A standard people put upon themselves. When you're in a profession, this is the standard of our profession. If you fall below that, you're not being professional. Sorry. And and we should try to just treat normalcy like that too, or at least, or maybe not even that too, but also understand that there's a diversity of people, and we should create standards and we should create normalcy that allows for that to happen, rather than have it be one sort of grand image in the sky.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of talk about embracing change and diversity. And it's great to talk the talk, but when it really comes down to actually including people who are considered to be quote-unquote different or deviate from the norm, people tend to get a little uncomfortable, and I have to kind of confront them with, like, why does this make you uncomfortable? Why does it make you uncomfortable to be with people that are different? Is it because you yourself may have a little bit of difference in you that you don't want to think about? I could be projecting, but...
I don't know. Like as long as you don't do it to harm people or harm yourself, I don't see what the problem is with asking those types of questions.
Yeah.
But no, and also, but no, returning back to particularly a social model, again, it emerged out of sociology.
Mm-hmm.
And what sociologists kind of do that's very different from, let's say, medical professionals or anything like that, it's a big picture conception of the mm-hmm. world. So, like, society have individuals in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of them have apparent disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to understand, well, why do they get classified that way? And what is barring them from, you know, participating more in society
mm-hmm.
or being, you know, deemed lesser or anything like that? So the social model also bleeds over to later movements and concepts like neurodivergent. Neurodivergency was basically, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, maybe after the ad break or something like that, but neurodivergency is sort of like a group term.
Mm-hmm.
And it meant for people, not just autistic, but also people who, again, ADHD, ADD, other differences in neurological setup.
Yeah.
And neurodivergent conversations,
mm-hmm.
They're called neurotypical. People who can pass as neurotypical, is sort of like the difference is the thing that is like the standard or the normal,
mm-hmm.
who can like pass as normal, when neurodivergent people don't have that opportunity for whatever reason. So, I don't know if there's any other questions you'd like to ask about this topic or.
No, I feel like we've covered the social model and the medical model pretty well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we'll go to ad break right now. But when we're back, Jack, I'd love to talk about your personal experience.
Okay, cool, cool. Yeah. Let's do this.
So we will return shortly.
All right.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people, so check out the real deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. The jazz feature that focuses on a concept, an album, or an individual artist will be heard at the beginning of the show every Monday night, right at 9 p.m., after our opening theme and announcement. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
For ways to be a part of the community through low-stakes opportunities like volunteering? What about making friends that are really cool or have some common interests? Well, I'm here to tell you that at CITR, you can come volunteer at Volunteer Wednesdays, happening every other Wednesday from 12 to 3 with a really fun activity each time, like making signs or button making. Not only is it a great break from outside stress, but a great opportunity to be a part of the community. For more information, you can visit CITR's Instagram page at CITR and Discorder.
Hi again, this is Nicole, and you're listening to All Access Pass, a show brought to you by the Accessibility Collective at CITR 101.9 FM, and we are back here with Jack.
Hello.
So Jack, okay, really, really big question. How do you identify? I mean, there's so many, like, answers to that question, but in terms of neurodivergence.
Well, my pronouns are he and him. But, like, this is kind of, like, no, I'm just playing with words right now. But, yeah. No, I would say that I'm someone who is high-functioning autistic,
okay.
Which in and of itself is kind of problematic because high-functioning basically means that you can pass as neurotypical. Or, like, what I was talking about beforehand, like, when I would drop the knowledge of me being autistic to someone or me being on the autism spectrum because it's mm-hmm. a huge spectrum, they say, like, wow, you don't come off like that at all.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit of like, and like, I don't think that they're being overtly malicious when they're saying that.
But there's a little bit of, it's like backhanded, you know? It's a backhanded compliment.
Yeah. It's sort of like slapping someone with a smile. But in all seriousness, I was diagnosed when I was 2 years old.
Which is quite young.
Oh, yeah. And this was also during the time in the 90s as well. So I got diagnosed when I was like in 96 and all that type of stuff.
Yeah.
And the social model was kind of developing around that time, but it wasn't mainstream. So the only language that was available to people at that time was treating it as a disease or a mm-hmm. disorder. You know, like not really putting it directly, like not saying like, it's unless you're like autism speaks,
yeah.
You don't really view, you, like no, most people don't view autism as an illness, but the way that the language is around it, mm-hmm. it frames it in a way that's like an illness. Again, it comes back to the identity first language and all that type of stuff, and because of that, but my parents put me in what they thought was the best treatment at the time, particularly when it came to speech therapy
mm-hmm.
and what's called applied behavioral analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And funny enough, I'm taking a course here on the history of psychology, and we talked about behaviorism.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, if any psychology listeners here will know kind of like, you know, the Watson, Skinner, Pavlov, Pavlovian conditioning, operative mm-hmm. conditioning, all that type of stuff. And that played like a lot, particularly Skinner's work, B.F. Skinner's work, played a lot into what later became ABA, which is Applied Behavioral Analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is basically someone who does analysis, or I don't really know what the direct terminology is, but Someone who does an analysis on a child,
yeah,
and then they apply behavioral, you know, methods to curtailing
mm-hmm.
certain unwanted behaviors of the child.
Mm-hmm.
One example is token economy. So there's a token economy. So basically, good behavior is done. When you do a good behavior, you're given a token.
Yeah,
like it'd be like a gold star or something like that. And
this is Pavlov.
Yeah, Pavlovian. Yeah. Like very basic conditioning.
Yeah.
And when you do something bad, you have a gold star taken away.
Yeah.
And I remember one time I had to deal with every day after school I had someone come in, and they were an applied behavioral analysis person, and they were I had to play games or anything like that and all that type of stuff, and I said a bad word once. I didn't know why it was a bad word. Like, when you're a little kid,
you don't know.
And you just say a curse word.
You're being punished for something you don't understand.
Yeah. Well, no, that's what I did. I got a token taken away. And I was just like, well, why? I was never given a why. A behavioral analysis is not about the why. It's about how do we curtail this kid's unwanted behaviors. And sometimes, and this wasn't in my experience, but sometimes that sort of techniques can get really abusive.
Borderline abusive. That reminds me a lot of just generally, I feel like a lot of children, a lot of times, like, it is a parent's responsibility to teach a child how to operate within a society that is, like, it is, like, a private sphere legal argument thing.
Yeah.
But it's always very interesting to me because sometimes, like, a kid will do something wrong and the right thing to do is for the parent to sit down and be like, hey, this is not something we should do and this is why, and take the time to explain it to a child. But sometimes the parent just doesn't have patience and it's just like, don't do that.
Yeah.
Or perhaps the child keeps doing it despite understanding the reasons not for doing it.
Yeah.
But in the case of this specific instance that you're explaining, behavioral intervention,
yeah, this person was not my parent. Like, yeah. This was like, and this is another and this is another concern that happens a lot too when it comes to
You're not teaching the child how to operate within society. You're just punishing the child for reasons they don't understand.
Yeah,
teaching a child how to exist within society would be much more compassionate of a response.
Yeah, I also think that there's a lot of times where you segregate. And this is a very strong word because it has a lot of racial connotations. But when you segregate a population of people and looked over another group of people, and they're looked over by like other group of people, like you know, that could be a very bad breeding ground for abuse, like I've heard a lot of horror stories about people who are neurodiverse or hanging on an SSW. An SSW means social support worker. My brother made a joke once that they kind of, like, SS kind of reminds you of SS officers from the Nazis.
Oh, God.
And it was just like, that's a bit of an edgy joke, dude. Like, yeah. they're not evil in that way. Yeah. But sometimes they, because you're handing a kid who might have communication issues to someone you don't even know,
mm-hmm.
and this is not to say that social support workers are very important. Like, in high school, I had one social support worker. Her name was Shelley, and she basically just taught me English because I wasn't. I'm not going to say I wasn't allowed to, but they didn't think I was appropriate to be in a class setting with a lot of the time with people because of anger issues.
Mm-hmm.
She was great. Like, she literally just taught me she taught me English, she taught me earth science when I was I actually was falling asleep in a science class once, and the science teacher did not want any of that and basically just, you know, said like, "Look, like, I'm not teaching this kid. You can basically just, you know, deal with it yourself and all that type of mm-hmm. stuff." And, like, yeah, so I basically got a alternative science education through literally them just teaching me, being a one-on-one teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are some SSWs, and I'm not going to name this person, but I remember one time I lost my – this was all in high school, so
mm-hmm.
I biked down to a restaurant. I think it was, like, McDonald's, like, literally at the McDonald's at the village there. And I lost my key
mm-hmm.
and to my bike lock because I had to lock my bike up and all that type of stuff. And mm-hmm. I just walked back up to my school and I would sit down a little bit angry, a little bit mad at myself. And one of the SSWs did not like that. So they literally just dragged me out of school. We walked back down to the McDonald's. It turned out that I just threw my key into the garbage by mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that happens, like, and all that type of stuff. But that wasn't good enough, so they basically opened up the bag of the garbage, this is like McDonald's, like rotten Big Macs and Cold Fries and drinks were in this bag. And they literally found the key, opened it up, gave it to me, and then lectured me about, like, oh, you should find things better. Like, you should, like, learn to find things better.
That is abusive.
No, yeah. Well, again, I don't really want to name them, but because I don't know if they're still working today.
Also, yeah, we probably shouldn't dox people on air. but, yeah, that is, like...
But no, like, that's sort of the people that go into that type of work. Like,
that happens to people in general.
Yeah.
That's just a pretty, like, it's just a thing that happens.
Oh, yeah. And this is what happened. But again, like, that's not even the worst case scenario. Like, the worst case scenario is literal physical abuse.
Yeah.
Like, I knew a kid. Dude was low functioning. So, like, a lot of communication problems, a lot of issues, like, and also bipolar. So they could be, like, really happy one moment and then just insane and just, like, very angry the next.
Yeah.
And again, this is – it's a lot of it, you all, like, you got to understand that as well. And, like, you got to understand that aspect of them as well and, like, not hold them to an extreme regard, to an extreme account. But there was one story. He went to a special – there's a lot of these special organizations that help with people – with mental disabilities, and he was acting up one day, and I'm parroting this from their mother, and they basically said one of the SSW, they had to take him out, and they had to, I don't know if they did a legal case, but they clearly had the justification to, but an SSW literally just pushed them on the ground, and pavement, and basically made them calm down. And I don't know what happened. I don't know the rest of the details, but, like, I remember around the time when I saw them, it was like, hey, how you doing? Quiet as can be, because it was literally a month afterwards, and
it's traumatizing.
Oh, no, it's horrifying.
It's incredibly traumatizing this relates a lot also to wellness checks for mental health.
Yeah.
And how... someone who is crying violently, screaming, but not showing signs of physical aggression is suddenly pinned down by the police and dragged across the floor.
Oh, no, it wasn't the police. It was an
SSW. I know, but in this specific, other scenarios for wellness checks, when someone calls the police on a mentally ill person, it is oftentimes the, like, worst possible thing you could do. And it's tricky because there's no one to call as, like, an interventionist for someone with a mental illness. But calling the police almost always guarantees use of force.
Well, yeah, because they view everything that's not a no as, like, I have a very, like, this is more about my philosophy. This is more of a philosophy for how I deal with police. And, like, anybody on air should, like... don't take up this logic if you don't feel comfortable with it. But I just learned to say no with everything when it comes to police. Like, where were you? Like, were you here on this night? No. Were you there on this night? No. Do you have any thoughts of hurting yourself? No. Because they will use any other thing other than no as a yes.
Yeah.
So, like, will you hurt yourself? Will you hurt others? Well, maybe. And then you just get the cuffs slapped on you.
Yeah.
That's how they that's how they're trained to interpret stuff.
Yeah. And it really, that's like a whole other can of worms, but it's how society reacts and tries to mitigate potentially violent outbursts from those who are neurodivergent, those who are mentally ill, because I believe they deserve to be treated with respect.
Yeah.
And oftentimes using physical violence imparts more trauma and less trust in a system that is, like, supposed to be rehabilitating you. So I am very sorry to hear about your experience and also your friend's experience. That's pretty awful.
Well, I wouldn't really say they were my friend, but, like, they were just a dude I knew because, like, autistic parents of autism usually hang out with each other and, you know, do organizations and all that type of stuff. And, like, honestly, there is a bit of a community when it comes to that. Like, like, again, we were talking about my class. Like, I knew there was this one other student. I'm not going to mention their name, but they do research here as well. And I always enjoy when they make a conversation because they always relate it back to their research.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, like, yeah, like, I'm autistic too. And it's like, and like, they, and like, they didn't have to deal with applied behavioral analysis like I did. But basically, they did, they analyzed it from a theoretical point of view. Mm-hmm. So they broke it down, like, look, this is where the flaws are. It doesn't deal with behaviorism doesn't deal with the internal sense of what a person is.
Yeah.
It only deals with behaviors and doesn't deal with, like, you know, a person's character. And that was like a very intentional thing. Behaviorism mm-hmm. as a psychological movement was meant to avoid talking about stuff like the mind or mentalness or mental activities or consciousness and just focus on behaviors. So, like, you know, like inputs, outputs, action, reaction, stimulus, response. And the thing about, like, the thing, you know, like, you can have a decent model for, you know, the psychological life of a basic organism with that. But when it comes to humans, you know, it's inadequate at best, and can be very harming at worst. And also in dehumanizing as well, because mental activities and just consciousness is also related to stuff like, again, going back to what makes a person a person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like someone having integrity, autonomy, and all that type of stuff. With behaviorism, it was a deterministic system. There was no autonomy. There was no free will. Like, a person doesn't really act on their own accord. They act by the environment that they're put into. And, you know, again, psychology has moved far past that. But you still have behavioral interventions to a very sensitive population whose methods and methodology is still based on a very, what can be kind of considered a very primitive form of psychological description.
Yeah.
And that's why the social model is so important too, because, again, you talk about interconnection and connected, like, these topics interconnect with, like, you know, how policing is done, how schooling is operated, and how, you know, just the concept of normalcy it gets instantiated into the world, into our world at least. So hopefully I'm not rambling on. I can sometimes do that.
No worries. Yeah, I think that, I mean, I kind of came into this episode today knowing that we were going to talk about the system that was created to quote unquote support those who have been identified as neurodivergent.
Yeah.
And I know that very closely ties into people with mental illness. But it's always like a little bit more discouraging to hear about it. But in a way that's like, it's one of those things where I hope we'll look back on it one day and be like, wow, that was barbaric, and now is so much better. It's like what you said at the beginning of this episode about how people thought that autism was like an early onset schizophrenia, and now we're like, that's not true. Like,
yeah,
I thank God we're out of that time.
Yeah, but like, yeah, but like, yeah, there is disparaging stuff, and maybe I can be a little bit doom and gloom, and like with my description about like. Because like when I was describing my life circumstances with you and these little moments I've had with people who are participating in a system that's meant to quote unquote support people with my setup, mm-hmm. like I didn't really view it as like a bad. Maybe this is because of maturity, but like I didn't really view it as a bad thing. I just view it as something that happened to me.
Yeah.
Like maybe
so you don't feel victimized. You feel uplifted.
I don't feel either way. I just kind of view it as like, well, this thing happened to me, and like, yeah, if I was a victim in that circumstance, I was a victim in that circumstance, but I'm not going to be a victim in every other circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
Like the neurodivergency community, a lot of it, like a lot of those terms came about because people who were diagnosed with the same neurological setup that I was started speaking up, and the internet was a big reason for that. Like, funny enough, I think it was an I can't remember their name exactly, but they were the first person to kind of coin the term the social model for disability
mm-hmm.
was actually quoted with having some autistic tendencies,
mm-hmm.
which is a very interesting thing.
Yeah.
But again, like, neurodivergency as a term came about within people who were labeled autistic, ADHD, ADD, Asperger's, and they all just sort of, like, all that term came about within those group of people talking to one another. Mm-hmm. And they described, that's how they labeled themselves. And it was the label that they decided to put upon themselves. It's a choice.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, in that regards, there's a little bit of, you know, uplift when it comes to that type of stuff. Like, a lot of the time, or, like, nowadays at least, there are organizations on campus, as here on this campus as well, that have organizations that are for physical and mental, quote unquote, disabilities. And they're run by people who are themselves that way. Like, you're going to have an invest, like, honestly, like, you're going to, like, I would rather deal with an organization that's run by people who are from that community.
Yeah, you know, like, for sure.
Would you trust, like, organization that deals with, like, indigenous issues, but is only done by white people?
Yeah, exactly.
No, that it's was, like, that would,
that's exactly.
I would run away from that organization.
Yeah, because I'm like, what do you know? Like, yeah. Who are you really advocating
for? Yeah.
Like, what personal experience can relate to?
Yeah.
No, I absolutely, it's like, yeah, like, I've had so many experiences where I've seen diversity panels and, like,
it's all white women. Well, particularly
all white women, all, like, white women, white men. And I'm standing there and I'm like, geez, I'm the diversity hire in a freaking diversity panel.
Well, no, when you see that, you should basically say screw that and start your own little diversity panel. Because, like, institutions that have been historically white are just by, like, if we're going to go by predictions or anything like that, they're going to continue to be white. Like, if you're trying to find power and you're trying to find uplift in an organization or an institution that created the conditions of your downtroddenness, mm-hmm. why are you expecting anything else? I don't really want to end this on a bad note. I want to end it on a really good note, because yeah. There are organizations that are uplifting, but raising awareness and bringing about changes to how people view both disability, both mentally and physically. Like, again, like, I can only talk about being autistic. I can't, you know, make a claim for anybody else in the neurodivergent community. But, you know, we're not, you know, it's a lot better now than it has been.
It's just going to take people to keep talking about it to make it even better.
Yeah. And it's also, like, defending rights, too. And defending achievements and defending organizations and making sure that, you know, one, they get the resources they need to actually, you know, be flourishing people.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I think at the end of the day, maybe that was one of the things that, you know, the medical model tried to do. It's like, all right, these people have a disease. How do we get rid of that disease so they can flourish? Like, it might have came from a good place, but it can easily be used for bad things.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And there are, like, certain things where it's like, I'd love to live life without MS, but, you know, like, for some people, it's like, why would I want to live life as any other person than I am right now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. It's a very, like, personal thing.
Oh, yeah. And, again, like, I would hope that we entered into this conversation in a mature and intelligent way, and a way that makes good distinctions, and that, mm-hmm. you know, addresses concerns in a very thoughtful and decent manner.
Yeah. On that note, thank you so much for coming on. I feel like we all learned a lot about the social and medical model of disability when it pertains to neurodivergence. And thank you for sharing your story. And I really hope to do a segment another time.
Yeah.
On what it and what maybe a proper form of intervention would be. But
there have been models that have been developing. But again, that's a different story for a different
another show.
Different show. Yeah. But no, just I would. tell anybody just to do their own research. Like, don't take my word entirely for it. Like,
and ask the person you're talking to.
Yeah, yeah.
The best way is just to ask.
Yeah, yeah. Ask in a politeful manner.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, there are asking that's just horrible.
Yeah,
but hey, are you mentally deficient? Yeah, that's not a great question. Like, thanks. Yeah. Thank you.
But anyways, thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week where we will be finishing off All Access Pass with one last episode about Maid. And yeah, have a good night, everyone.
Okay.